Holding on to some chavav, amud beis by the Mishnah at the bottom. Continuing with the details of the procedure involving the sar la'azazel. So we said that the guy takes the sar la'azazel, the ish iti takes the sar la'azazel, takes it and starts heading towards the cliff called Azazel. We'll see in the Gemara. We'll see in the Gemara why it's called that. Anyway, so the Mishnah says Mi'akira Yerushalayim. Some of the important people, the Akira literally means the precious people. So it means it actually says Chashuvei Yerushalayim, the important people of Yerushalayim. So some of them, Hoya Malavin Osead Sukkah Rishona. Some of them would accompany him as far as the first sukkah. So the mission is going to say there were a bunch of sukkahs built before Yom Tov between Yerushalayim and the cliff, and some people would walk with him from Yerushalayim until the first sukkah. Esa sukkahs Yerushalayim van suk. There were 10 sukkahs made on the way. People would go and stay in those sukkahs before Yom Kippur. They would stay in each of those sukkahs over Yom Kippur. And that way they could walk him, that way they could accompany him from one sukkah to the next. So there were 10 sukkahs. The total distance was tish imris. There were 90 ris from Yerushalayim until the tzuk. And a ris is shivo mechza l'chol mil. There are 7.5 ris per mil. A mil is 2,000 amos. So ris comes out to 266 amos in a little bit. So that was the total distance. So therefore, in other words, so the 10, now the Gemara is going to mention a few different opinions, how these sukkahs were laid out, how much was the distance between one and the next. Our Mishnah is taking the view that the first one was 1 mil away from Yerushalayim, the second one was 1 mil away from that, and so forth. So the 10th sukkah was 10 mil from Yerushalayim, from there until the cliff, from there until Azazel is 2 mil. So we'll see. We'll see what's so the deal with that is, therefore, so you have people are able to accompany him the whole time. So you have the people from Yerushalayim are able to accompany him the first meal, and then they turn around and go back home because it's Yom Kippur and they can't walk outside the Tum unless they make an Erev Chatzeres, as we're going to say in the Gemara. Not an Erev Tumen, I mean, as we're going to say in the Gemara. Then people from the first sukkah would accompany him to the second one and then turn back. People from the second sukkah would accompany him to the third one, and so on and so forth. Until you get to the 10th sukkah, the 10th sukkah is 2 mil away from the cliff. So now that one, they can't walk with him all the way. Instead, they would, instead they'd walk with him 1 mil, and then they'd watch from a distance of 1 mil. Now why didn't they just make an 11th sukkah? So there's a few different reasons. Tosfos Yeshanim talks about possibilities. Maybe what it is you don't want that the people should actually be there to watch from close what's going on with the strip of wool. We said before, we learned before, and we're going to learn in more detail in the Gemara over here, that you had the strip of red wool, that if everything was good and Hashem had completely forgiven the Jewish people for their avodas, then the strip would turn white. On the other hand, we said not always did that happen. So therefore, you don't necessarily want people to be up close and personal over there to watch that. So therefore you made it that the last sukkah is 2 mil away. That way they can't walk that last mil with him. There's a few other reasons that are given. One of them is that you don't want it to appear as though the sur was sent by more than one person, where the pasuk says it has to be ish iti, one person. And the Tosfos Yeshan, and not Tosfos Yeshan, and Tosfos Yom Tov says a reason because, since, as we're going to say in the Gemara, the place is called Eretz Gzeira, which means a cut off land, so it has to be cut off, it has to be desolate of people if you had an 11th sukkah or a 12th sukkah closer to the cliff, then you'd be able to have people there, then it wouldn't be completely desolate. This ris, by the way, so you have a ris is not a very common unit of measurement. But it is mentioned in a number of places in the Gemara. Why we're mentioning it over here, why we don't just say 12 mil, one possibility is maybe a ris was a more familiar unit of measurement to most people. Again, a ris, we said, is 266 amos and a little bit, which seems like a very odd figure. Somebody once suggested to me, Yossel Keller once suggested to me, maybe what it is, you know, if we think about how big is an amma, according to the Avraham Chaim Noah, at any rate, an amma is 1.5 feet. So we could suppose that in those times, besides that they had the measurement of an amma, they may have also had a measurement of 1 foot similar to ours. It didn't have to be exactly 12 inches like ours, but it may have been something in that range. And if you figure it out, then a wrist would be 400 of those. which is a nice round number. So maybe that's why they use that unit. Anyway, the point is there are 90 of those. It's 12 mil from your shalayim until Azazel. Continues the Mishnah. Now, I'll call sukkah a sukkah omrin lo. When he came to every one of the 10 sukkahs, they would tell him, hare mozen v'hare mayim. There's water here and there's food here. Now, the Gemara is going to say, not necessarily is it that he's going to eat and drink. It is Yom Kippur, after all. But this way it would make him feel better knowing that there is food and drink available. Tosfos Hashanim discusses various possibilities. Is it that he'd be able to eat and drink, even if it's Pekuach Nefesh, no question he could eat and drink. But if it was something less than that, would he be allowed to? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe on the one hand, we need him to have his strength in order to be able to reach Azazel with the goat and accomplish the mitzvah to throw it off over there. So therefore, maybe even if he's just weak, not that his life is in danger, but just that he's weak, maybe that would be a reason for him to be able to eat and drink over there. The Rambam says similarly that koshal koichai, that if his strength is weak, then he's allowed to. Just like the same way we said before, for example, he's allowed to walk outside the tchum, even though normally that would be also on Yom Kippur, because this is part of the mitzvah. He's allowed to throw off the goat, even though that usually you're not allowed to kill an animal on Yom Tov, but on Yom Kippur. So this would be the same kind of thing. Or is it that the food is only available if he's actually dangerously ill? And the point is, other than that, as the Gemara is going to say, it's just to make him feel better. Knowing that there's food itself psychologically makes him feel better and more able to carry it out. Okay. Umlavan oisim sukkah l'sukkah. So again, they would accompany him from one sukkah to the next. Chutz me'achon shebehem, with the exception of the people in the 10th sukkah, she'enim agia ima l'tzuk. They wouldn't walk with him all the way to the tzuk. They can't because it's 2 mil away and they were only able to walk 1 mil. Ela oimin merochet v'roya es maisav. Rather, the person stands from afar and watches what the guy is doing with the sar la'azazel. Why you need to watch him? Well, first of all, Mistama, they'd be curious, but the Siach Yitzchak actually brings from the Zohar that the Ish Iti, now we said yesterday, we brought from the Chizkuni that the Kohenim would pick somebody who they knew with Ruach HaKodesh is going to pass away during the coming year. The Zohar says, Bechlal, the guy was not necessarily such a great guy. He was a pogrom, he's a balmum or whatever, so therefore there might be more reason to have to watch him to make sure that he's doing things right. So what would this guy do with the sar la'azazel? Cholik loshen shel zahoris. He would tear the strip of wool in half. Now, which strip of wool? Now, we learned earlier in the Masechta that they would tie a strip of wool, a ribbon of wool, on the head of the sar la'azazel in order to be able to distinguish it from the sar la'ashem and from the other serum that might be around there. So then it might be the same. It might be the same strip of wool. On the other hand, Tosfos Hashanim points out, don't you have a problem? You're not allowed to. One of the malachas that you know, one of the things you're not allowed to do on Shabbos, even though it's not really separately one of the 39 malachas, you're not allowed to have an animal carry something for you on Yom Tov or on Shabbos. I'm not on Yom Tov, on Shabbos or on Yom Kippur. It's called mechamer. We learned about it a while back at the very end of Masechta Shabbos. So over here, wouldn't it be mechamer that you're having, you're making the animal go and it's carrying this strip of wool? So two possibilities. One is that it's kalachayad, because that's not a normal way of carrying it on its head over there between its horns. Therefore, at least on a daraisa level, it might be mutter, and here where it's necessary, then they'd allow it even to rabbanon. Or the other possibility, Tosfos Hashanim says, is actually maybe it's not the same strip of wool. Maybe they would bring a strip of red wool to the cliff before Yom Kippur, and now that's the one that the guy would divide in two and do what he's going to do now. So chetzia kosher basela, half of it he would tie to a rock, the chetzia kosher ben shnei karnov, the other half he would tie between the horns of the animal. We'll see in the Gemara why he did that, why he didn't just keep it as one piece. Anyway, the dochva la, another interesting point, by the way, is over here, another malacha, another potential malacha that you have over here. Okay, so the fact that he's tearing it up, fine, the fact that he's dividing it in half, fine, that's the malacha of Kerea, but that's a malacha only, that's Daraisa, at least, it's a malacha only if he's doing it amanas lichbar, having in mind to sew it back up, and of course here he's not. So it's only Dirabbanan, and we can say the Chachamim were mater it because it's necessary, but what about the malacha of kosher, that he's tying it? So there was an interesting discussion about this among Achronim, that maybe, granted, of course, he's tying it and he's not intending to untie it, but given that he's tying it and then throwing it away, he's throwing the goat down the cliff and he's never going to see it or the thing again, maybe that wouldn't be considered kosher, at least not on a Daraisa level. Even though it's permanent, he doesn't care whether it's permanent. The Maharil Diskin talks about this. I think Rabbi Shlomo Zalman talks about this. It's an interesting nafkamina comes from it as far as disposable diapers, where you put on the tabs over there, you stick the tabs in place, and afterwards when you're done with it, you take the diaper and again you put the tabs in place and then you throw it in the garbage. So on the one hand, it's permanent. You're not going to undo them afterwards. On the other hand, you're throwing them away. And so there's that. On the other hand, it's not necessarily a solid proof, because maybe when they threw the goat down the cliff, maybe the knot would tend to come untied as it's falling down.
You need the kavana to untie it to be called a kosher?
No, but the raisa, what it is actually that a kesher shok hayama, the kind that a person is chayav for, is the kind where you tie it and you intend to keep it tied like that forever. But in other words, the point is that you tie it and you want to keep the thing around, not in this case. On the other hand, if you have, for example, if you have a knot which you're planning to undo the same day, then it's not, then generally you are allowed to tie some knots on Shabbos. Here we have sort of a middle ground. You're tying a knot which is going to stay permanent. You have no intention of going down the cliff and untying it, unless, of course, it comes off by itself. On the other hand, the fact is, you're throwing it away, you don't really care whether it stays tied or not. So the Maharil Diskin talks about maybe such a thing is not considered a malacha of kosher, at least on a Daraisa level.
So you seem to, you said before that you need the intent of undoing it.
Then I misspoke. What I mean is that you need the intention either that you're going to undo it that day, or that if it's going to stay, or if it's going to stay longer, that you're actually going to keep it around rather than throwing it away. So that first part, if you intend to untie it that day, then you're allowed in general. That's halacha and shulchan aruch. But the point that we're saying over here, that even if you're tying it permanently, like a diaper or like a garbage bag or whatever, where you're never intending to untie it, but you're also throwing it away and you don't really care what happens with it, that's a chiddush of the Maharil Diskin, where he says, based on our Gemara, maybe we would say that such a thing is also mutter.
So what is the exact halacha? Is it a double knot?
Tying something which you're going to untie that day, like shoelaces or whatever, then you're allowed to. And if you're tying it, then it's going to stay for longer than a day, then you have questions of whether you're allowed to or not. Sometimes it's also daraisa, sometimes it's also derabanan, and then you have this question over here where if you're throwing it away, would it actually be mutter?
So a double knot that you intend to undo the same day is not...
We're not talking about a single knot, unless we're talking about in one row.
No, I'm talking about a double knot that you intend to undo. Is it a malacha or not?
So technically, no. In practice, though, instead of doing that, when you're tying your shoelaces, for example, don't tie a double knot, tie a bow tie. All right, let's go. But yes, technically, if you're planning to untie it that day and you untie it every day, like shoelaces or other things like that, then you're allowed. All right, let's go on. So he takes this piece of, he takes this strip of red wool, he divides it in half, half of it he ties to a rock, half of it he ties between the two horns of the animal, but he pushes it backwards down the cliff. He has to push it backwards, because if he pushes it forward, a goat is a pretty sure-footed animal, it's just going to run down the cliff.
What is the kind of the rock?
We're going to see in the Gemara why he ties half of it to the rock. So the animal is rolling down the cliff over there. It wouldn't even reach the midpoint of the mountain before it was broken up into individual limbs. In the Seder Havodah, when we say it on Yom Kippur, we say the guy would add a line over there, so may the Averis of the Jewish people be erased. Next, Bava Yashav Laitachas Sukkah Achrona Ad Shetechshach. Then, remember, he's 2 mil away from the last sukkah. Nevertheless, we allow him to, in this case, to go out of the tchum. He goes and sits back in the last sukkah, the 10th sukkah, until it gets dark. The reason is, Rashi says, now he's outside of the tchum. Usually he should only have 2,000 out. Even now you have the Gemara, we learned in Erevin, the Gemara mentions in Rosh Hashanah, that when a person goes outside the tchum, originally the din was that he only has 4 amos. Later on, the Chachamim said, fine, he has 2,000 amos, as if he's in his original home base. But here he'd have to be walking even more than 2,000 amos. However, you don't want the poor guy, he's fasting and he's going to be afraid. I don't know if it's hot necessarily, maybe not, but to stay out there all alone in the desolate desert until it gets dark, it would be scary. So therefore we allow him to walk back to the last sukkah until it gets dark. It's sort of al derech, like when you have, you know, a person goes on a hatzolah call on Shabbos, he has to a certain extent the ability to come back to where to his home base in order to be available for the next one and in order to that people should be willing to go on hatzolah call. So here it's a similar thing. Okay. Now the pasuk tells us that the one vam shaleach has a sar la'azazel, the one who sends off the sar la'azazel becomes tamei, and he has to dip himself and his clothes in a mikveh. In other words, he becomes an avatoma, and his clothes become a rishon latoma. So u'me'emasam tamei begodim. At what point during this whole procedure does he and his clothes become tamei? And mishiyetzei chutz l'chomis Yerushalayim, once he leaves the walls of Yerushalayim with the goat. Reb Shimon says no, only when he pushes the animal off the cliff. We'll see in the Gemara what the basis of their machlokes is.
For the first person, you see that once you go out of this line, the chazak is that the floor is in common.
No. Well, in Eretz Yisrael in general, we're not machzik tumah. No. Not even Yerushalayim. In the whole Eretz Yisrael, we're not machzik tumah. What you're talking about, kivrei goyim, is mostly an issue in chutz la'aretz. No. What you have is it's true that sometimes there are times when we try to be extra careful with the parah adruma. For example, we have the whole causeway for the parah adruma is arches on top of arches to prevent any possibility of tumah. But that's because of the parah adruma, we do unusual things like that. But when it comes over here, there's no reason to assume that when he's walking around over there outside Yerushalayim on Har HaZeisim or in the desert over there, that there's Davka body buried underneath. So that's not the issue. No, it's Gzeiras HaKosev that as soon as he, that the guy who does the Sar La'azazel becomes Tomei, and therefore the question is at what point. Okay, so the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa, Esther Sukkos Ushneimos Milin Hoyo Divir Amei. Reb Meir says there were 10 sukkahs and the total distance was 12 mil, as we said in the Mishnah. You think about it, by the way. So a mil, according to Rav Avram Chaim Noah, is about 3/5 of a mile. According to the Chazon Ish, it's about 4/5. So the 12 mil that we're talking about over here is over 7 miles, according to Rav Avram Chaim Noah, and about 12 miles, according to about 10 or 11 miles, according to the Chazon Ish.
Right.
Yeah, indeed, it would be a few hours. We're going to learn at the end of the perek that they couldn't continue with the next part of the avodah until the goat was pushed off the cliff. So, or we're going to have one opinion until it comes to the midbar. So, yeah, they would obviously have to have a break in the middle of the avodah. So we said if it died, as long as it died after the blood of the Sar Lashem was finished with, then it's not ma'akid to be avodah, right? So yeah, I guess if that happened in a year like that, I guess they could finish up the avodah really quick. On the other hand, then they you know, like this, you know, the like this, the mitzvah hasn't been done the ideal way. But yeah, there you go. Okay. So anyway, so Rav Meir says there were 10 sukkahs and 12 mil. Rav Yehuda omer teisha sukkahs va'asara milin. Rav Yehuda says there were only 9 sukkahs and only 10 mil. Tosfos and Tosfos Yeshanim bring a girsa that there were 10 sukkahs and 10 mil. Now, Tosfos Yeshanim says, what are you talking about? There's no reason for a 10th sukkah. The 9th sukkah then would be a mil away from the cliff. They could walk, that's 2,000 amas away. They could walk to the cliff with him. Now, obviously, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with what we said before, that nobody's allowed to be there, nobody's allowed to be close up. Obviously, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with it, but still, according to Tosfos Yeshanim says, why would there be a need even for a 10th sukkah? On the other hand, Tosfos says there could be a reason. The fact is, again, the guy's fasting, he's weak or whatever. After he's done with the Sar La'azazel, don't make him walk back 2,000 amas to find the nearest sukkah. Have a sukkah right there. That way, at least he has a place where right after he's done, he can go relax. Okay. Rabbi Yossi and Chomash Sukkahs Vasoda Milan Hoyu. Rabbi Yossi says there were only 5 sukkahs and there were 10 milan. V'chulon Ayudei Eruv, they connected one with the next through an Eruv Tchumen. In other words, you'd have the people in the first sukkah, let's say, would put down an Eruv Tchumen, and therefore they're able to walk. So what it means is, in other words, the sukkahs are each 2 mil apart. So you have, let's say, for example, the people of the first sukkah are putting down an Eruv Tchumen. They're allowed, therefore, their home base is 2,000 amas from one sukkah and 2,000 from the other. Therefore, they're allowed to walk 4,000 amas, 2 mil. So therefore, they're able to accompany him to the next sukkah and so forth with each of the other ones. Tosfos and Tosfos Yishanim discuss over here an interesting point, which is when we talk about a Tchum Shabbos, is it that you have 2,000 amos no matter what direction you're going in, or is it that only if you're going in one of the cardinal directions, north, south, east, or west, do you have only 2,000? But if you're going, let's say, northeast or southwest or what have you, then you'd have more because you have the diagonal. So over here, here it sounds like we're saying that we're not taking the diagonal into consideration, because who says that the cliff Lazozel was directly due east of Yerushalayim? Maybe it was northeast or northwest or something, and in that case, he should have more distance. So Tosfos says, okay, maybe in fact he does have. So maybe we say over here a mil. We just mean as a shorthand, meaning a Tchum Shabbos. Maybe in fact each sukkah was in fact 2,800 or whatever amos away from the previous one, because when you're walking in a diagonal, then you do in fact have that extra. You do in fact have that extra distance. No, so the Erev also, according to that, if you're walking northeast, let's say, then you would be able to put your Erev Tchumen anywhere within 2,800 or whatever it is, Amos or whatever the exact figure is, with Amos of the city, because your Tchum, remember we learned in Erev, and what do? You take the city, you square it off, and then you draw the Tchum, you measure 2,000 Amos in each direction, and then you square off the Tchum. So then it comes out in the corners, you have extra. Maybe over here we're talking about the same thing. Maybe not though. Maybe only when it comes to the cities of the Levium or whatever do we say that you have the extra, that you have the extra amounts, but maybe not necessarily in this case. Another possibility, of course, is that the cliff was in fact due east of Yerushalayim, and therefore each person only has 2,000 amps. All right, anyway, so Rabbi Yossi says they made an eight of Tchumen, and that's how they were able to go from one sukkah to the next, so they don't have to be a mil apart, they can be 2 mil apart, 4,000 amps. However, Omer Rabbi Yossi, Soch li Elazar b'ni, Rabbi Yossi says, my son Elazar spoke to me, and Soch, Rashi says, means a little bit of a joke, like he said it in a little bit of a joking way. Really, if once you're bringing in the possibility of an Erev Tchumen, then you could cover 10 mil with even only 2 sukkahs. What do? In other words, so you have the first sukkah can be 4 mil away from Yerushalayim. What do? You have some people in Yerushalayim put down an Erev Tchumen 1 mil away from Yerushalayim. So that's their home base. On Yom Kippur itself, therefore, they're allowed to walk. Let's say their house is next to the edge of the city, so they don't have a problem now. They can't walk that further back in the city. So let's say then from their house at the edge of the city, let's say they put down the Erev Tchumen 2,000 amos away. So now on Yom Kippur, they're able to walk that 2,000 amos and another 2,000 amos. Now then you have people from the first sukkah. Some people from that sukkah made an Erev Tchumen in the direction of Yerushalayim, 2,000 amos from their sukkah. So they're able to walk 2,000 and another 2,000. So they can meet the contingent from Yerushalayim together with the guy with the Sarim Shalayach and accompany him to their sukkah. So far, he's covered 4 mil. So he covered 2 mil together with the Yakir Yerushalayim and 2 mil with the people from the first sukkah. Other people in that sukkah make an Erev Tchumen in the other direction, 2,000 amos away. So they're now able to walk with him another 4,000 amos in that direction. Another 2 mil in that direction. People from the next sukkah, from the second sukkah, do the same kind of thing. Some of them made an Erev Tchumen in that direction, back towards Yerushalayim. So they were able to take over and accompany him the next 2 mil. So far, he's covered 8 mil, and there's only been 2 sukkahs so far. And then you have 2 more mil until the cliff, and they make an Erev Tchumen, and therefore they're able to walk with him all the way through the cliff. So you can cover the whole 10 mil with only 2 sukkahs.
Yeah, but the problem is he still goes beyond the Tchum, his own Tchum.
He's on even Tchum, the... no matter what. Right. Now, so we said yesterday, right? So we said that he has the heter. Now, we talked yesterday, even according to the Rambam and some other Rishonim, that the Tchum of 12 mil is Daraisa. But again, here they're telling him to do that. But again, according to Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, he's not going outside 12 mil anyway, because the whole distance is only 10 mil. And even according to the mayor, maybe it's slightly less than 12 mil. When he said 12 mil in the Mishnah, 90 units, he's rounding off. Maybe it's, 11 and a half mil or whatever. Yeah. But in any case, he has a head to do that because he has to do it.
Yeah, but this limit of 12 mil is just for him or what do we get?
On a dirt, again, Somebody's shown him a hold. Now, like this, you have opinions in the Gemara. You have Rabbi Akiva holds that a tum of 2,000 amos is daraisa. So fine. Obviously, according to him, this guy is going far past that, but that's fine because the Torah tells him to do that. According to all the other Chachamim, there is no tum of 2,000 amos daraisa. Now, within the opinion of the Chachamim, you have the opinion of the Rambam and a couple of other Rishonim that there is a tum of 12 mil daraisa, 24,000 amos. Then you have other Rishonim that hold that, no, daraisa, there's no tum at all. The whole concept of a tum, according to that, is only Dirabanan. Even if we say that a tum is daraisa, nevertheless, either we're saying that he has the heter to do it anyway because he has to, he's told to go to this cliff, or we're saying that it's actually within 12 hours, that it's actually within 12 mil, and therefore he's not, therefore he's not doing that tchum of 12 mil anyway. But yeah, everybody else obviously has the dinim of tchum Shabbos, and therefore the furthest they can walk is 4,000 if they make an eight of tchumen.
But what is the halacha? Is it the Oraisa? Is it the Rabbanan? Is it 12 mil? Is it 2 mil?
It's more than 12 mil, then you then it would be a case of pikuach nefesh anyway, and you're doing it regardless. Realistically, it's not really negeya. Whether it's daraisa or derabanan, either way, there's a limit how much you can go on Shabbos, and even if you make an eruv tchumen, it only doubles your limit, and that's that.
Okay, no, but what is it?
What is it? It depends who you ask. It depends whether you ask the Rambam or the other Rishonim. No, come on. Let's go on. So on the other hand, Tosfos Rosh says that, listen, you know, he was saying it only as a little bit of a joke, because the obvious answer is, so what? You're going to have these guys are going to have to be standing there for who knows how long until the people from Yerushalayim show up. You know, they didn't have a way of synchronizing it. So therefore, better to have the sukkahs a little closer together, and that way they can actually walk with him from one sukkah to the next without, and not that they reach some rendezvous in the middle of the desert over there, and they have to time things to all be there at the same time. So the Gemara says, "Keman ozla hodatanya." Now, who does it go like this? That it says in the continuation of the Braisa, "Chutz me'achron shebahem," that all of them would walk with him from one sukkah to the next, with the exception of the last one, Shalohi gia imay latzuk, who didn't walk with him all the way to the cliff, and the omen merochik veroya esmaisav, he would stand from far and watch what he's doing. Keman kerameir, that would necessarily be like Rameir. Now, we had that in the Mishnah as well, but the difference is in the Mishnah, obviously, we only have the one opinion that there were 10 sukkahs and 12 mil, so obviously it's according to that opinion. But Tosfos explains, in the Braisa over here, where we had three different opinions of how many sukkahs and how many milin there were, so now when the Braisa finishes off, that the last one couldn't walk all the way to the cliff, we have to clarify which of those three opinions is that statement following. And the answer is it's Rameir. So you have Rameir, you have the beginning of Rameir's opinion, then you have Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi interject with their statements about how many mil and how many sukkahs there were, and then Rameir finishes off, according to me, that there were 12 mil and 10 sukkahs, then it comes out the last guy couldn't walk all the way. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, called sukkah v'sukkah omrim lehare mozen v'hare mayim, every sukkah that he came to, they would offer him. He was water and he was food and he was water. Tana, so we learn in a braisa, ma'olam lehutzroch adam lakach. Nobody ever actually needed that. Either, you know, as we said before in the Mishnah, the question is he only allowed to eat it if his life is in danger? So then it would mean nobody was ever in that state. Or does it mean he's allowed to eat even if just he's feeling weak, but it never happened even that he felt weak? It's not comparable when a person has bread in his basket versus not. In other words, paspasaloi, that itself, psychologically, it makes him feel better. I can finish this off, given that I know there is water and food available if I need it. We said in the Mishnah, Mahayoi, so how would he do it? Cholik loshen shel zahoyres, he divided up the strip of wool and tied half of it to the rock and half of it between the horns of the animal. So the question is, why? V'nikture kolei v'sela, why doesn't he just tie the whole thing to the rock? The reason is, kibin the mitzvah v'sor, because after all, the mitzvah is to throw the sor off the cliff. Therefore, duma kodim umalbin, what might happen is, right before he throws it off, it might already turn white. Now, it wouldn't turn white while he's walking or something, but Tosfos Hashanim says, in other words, as he's about to finish the mitzvah, then it might turn white already at that point. And then umiyasvadite, so now already he's feeling good. He's feeling good, and therefore he's going to think that that's it. We don't have to do anything else. He may not remember then in that case that he has to actually push the goat off the cliff. He may think, good, the kapara has been accomplished. That's that. Like this, if you have half of it is tied on the animal's head, then the fact that he's tying it onto the animal's head is going to remind him, you know what, I got to do something with this animal. I can't just leave it here.
Wasn't his head all the whole way.
No, so that's what we said before. There's two possibilities, Tosfos Shonim says. Either it is the same one that was on his head, and now he took it and divided it in half and left half on its head, and the other half he tied to the rock. Or Tosfos Shonim had said, maybe you'd have a problem with Malach on Yom Kippur, of Mechamer, where he's causing an animal to walk with a burden on its head. So therefore, maybe the strip of wool that we're talking about over here was brought there before Yom Kippur. Was brought there before Yom Kippur. And now on Yom Kippur, he finds it over there and he takes it and tears it in half and so forth.
What's one of the ones
that so then according to that, there would be one that was tied someplace on the animal just in order to label it. But fine, that could be like you have it, let's say, you know, you need a rope around the animal's neck to be able to lead it. So then it could be tied to it, so then it could be part of that. So then it's not necessarily then it wouldn't be mechamer. Okay. Next, the nichtere kule ben karnov. Okay, so why don't we tie the whole strip between the animal's horns? The reason is zimnin de gomish leilereshe, because what happens is as the animal is falling, it may tuck in its head between its legs. The lava daite, then he's not going to be able to see. You want it to be able to see whether it turns white or not. Now, we said before, maybe we don't want the whole world to be able to see it. Therefore, that's one reason we said why we have people standing far away rather than accompanying them all the way to the cliff. So fine, they may not see from that distance, but he wants to be able to see whether it's red or white and be able to report to them afterwards. So like this, yeah, you want that some of it should be in a place on the rock where it's not going to get hidden, where he's going to be able to see if it turned white. And then the other one will be on the animal's head, and this way he won't forget to push it down. Okay, Tanan Abanam, we learn in a Braisa. Barishonah Yokoshin Loshin Shal Zahodas Apesach Ulam Mebachutz. Originally, they would tie the strip of wool to the outside door of the Ulam. And Hilbin, if it turned white, how you smith, and everybody was happy, because it showed the Eivishter had completely forgiven the Averis. Loy Hilbin, if it didn't turn white, how you at Savin, then they would be sad. And with Spishin, and they'd be embarrassed. So, Hiskinu Shi Yokoshin Apesach Ulam Mebachutz. Instead, they made a takana that they should tie it on the inside of the ulam. So that way it's not in front of everybody. That way it's on the inside. It's on the inside of the building. And still people could peek in and they could see, especially the ulam didn't have a door. It only had a curtain in front of it. So it was possible to peek in and see. If it's turned white, they would be happy. And if not, then they'd be sad. Fine, they're not going to be embarrassed because it's not there in front of the whole Jewish people, but still they'd be sad. Then they made the takana that instead he should take the strip of wool with him, and half of it goes on the rock, and half of it goes between the animal's horns. And that way, the only one who actually sees it turning white or not turning white is the actual guy who's doing the sur lazazel. Or fine, according to Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, also the people who accompanied him from the last sukkah. But the point is, it's a very small group. They can inform everybody else, but at least this way, it's not quite as embarrassing and humiliating to everybody. Here's another way of saying it. Originally, they would tie the strip of red wool on the inside of the door of the ulam. The kivinchi gia sur la midbar. As soon as the goat reached the desert, hoya malbin, then it would turn white. The yodush and nasis mitzvasei, and now they knew the mitzvah had been accomplished. Now we're going to talk about it at the very end of the perek. Is the mitzvah accomplished as soon as the goat reaches the edge of the desert, or do they have to actually reach the top of the cliff and throw it off in order for the mitzvah to be accomplished? So we'll see that tomorrow, Blessed Hashem. But this opinion over here might be according to the opinion that it's good enough once it reaches the desert. And the point is, they know the mitzvah has been done, and that way now the Kohen Gadol can go ahead with the next part of the avodah. So that's what we're saying. So we're going to say at the end of the parak, the possibility that maybe at least to the extent that you can continue the avodah, maybe once it reached the desert, that's good enough. After all, when you get down to it, the pasuk never actually says anything about throwing it all. It's la'azazel, but the pasuk actually says v'shilach hasasur b'midbar. So therefore, so one way, we're going to see on Amud Beis, there are a couple of possibilities. One possibility is that b'midbar, we're going to see on a little bit on Amud Beis, we're going to see more tomorrow, that one possibility is b'midbar, it just has to reach the midbar, and then already the mitzvah has been accomplished. Yeah, you still have to throw it off the cliff, but then at that, meanwhile, the Kohen Gadol can go ahead with the next part of the avodah. So the point is, when the strip was hanging over there and it turned white, then they'd know the mitzvah had been accomplished. Shenema, as the pasuk says, imyu chata'echem kashonim, even if your averus are red like scarlet, the Marsha on the Gemara over here compares it to dam nida, like you have eventually a nidi becomes tahor from it. Kashelik, yabinu, they'll become white as snow. So he has a whole explanation over there, the pnimius in yonim, that the red is a like a virus, make a person make the people dirty, like dam nida. But now what we're doing is we're putting it on the sur, which represents Esav, and Esav is red. How came Koreshmoy Edom, and therefore the all the red and all the averus and all the dirtiness goes away and gets thrown down the cliff with him, and we get cleaned up.
Nida, it's not avera.
Yeah, they don't.
There would be
No, not after Meir.
7 miles.
Okay, so let's figure it out then. According to
Alexander,
Alexander,
Damnida is not an Avera. Why do you say it's compared
nobody
to Damnida?
It's not. Nobody said that it's an Avera, but the fact is, it's still something that makes a person.
You said it's an Avera.
So therefore, it can stand in as a representation of Averus, which also make a person Tomei and dirty. Yeah. Okay.
Tumor and Avera are two different things, aren't they?
It's true they're two different things, but there's a certain relationship between them. So, okay. So let's make the calculation over here. 12 mil, according to the mayor. There's different opinions among the Shonim how long it takes to walk a mil. Anywhere between 18 and 24 minutes. So according to the opinion that it's 18 minutes to a mil, 12 mil would take a little over 3.5 hours. According to the opinion that it takes 24 minutes, then 12 mil would take a little less than 5 hours. So we're still not talking nightfall. Remember, the Kohen Gadol began the Avodah of Yom Kippur Trumas Hadesh, and we said took place even during the night. And then he shechts the Korban Tomid as soon as the rays of the sun are visible. So like right at Netzach Hamah. So even so let's say everything that he did from shechting the Tomid until this point when they send off the Sar Lazazel, let's say it took 3 or 4 hours. Fine, that brings us to, let's say, 10 o'clock in the morning. If now we have to wait 3 or 5 hours or whatever, fine, that brings us to two or three o'clock in the afternoon. There's still plenty of time in the day to finish the rest of the Avodah.
No,
avoid
most of the weather that has to be done in the afternoon.
So there is. There is. I mean, there's eventually a Talmud Rabbein HaBayim. But, right, but we still have the next thing the Kohen Gadol has to do after the Sur LaZazel is we're gonna learn tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, is he has to take the par and the Sur and take the Emurim of them and burn them on the Mizbeach and send them off to be burned. And then after that, then that's when there's the break. And then, so he does that during that break. And then after that, there's a break. And then the next thing that he's going to do at the beginning of the next parak is he's going to lean from the Torah. To do that, he has to wait until the Sur has been thrown off the cliff. So they have the break in between then. Mistama, you know, you'd have people would meanwhile be they're not going to just be later gayers during that time. I'm sure they're going to be sitting and learning about the dinim of Yom Kippur and about inyanim of Tshuva and so on and so forth. Okay, let's go on. The Mishnah had said Lohei Magia Lachat Namatzahar, that the goat wouldn't even reach the midpoint of the mountain before it was torn apart into limbs. So we have a question. Oisan Evorim Mahin Bahana. What would be the din about those Evorim? Or after the Sur LaZazel is done with, are those Evorim Mutar Bahana? Now, obviously, we're not going to say they're Mutar Bahachila because the goat wasn't shechted, it was thrown down the cliff. Although it's interesting, actually, the Minchas Chinuch in one place discusses maybe, yeah. We said the other day, it's like Shchita. So maybe al derech, like you have that malika of a bird makes it mutter to eat when it was brought as a korban. Maybe over here. But the Pashtos, he says maybe not. But most everybody else says that no, of course, it's not mutter b'achila. But the question is only b'hanah. So. That's what we have to see. Rav Shmuel, Chad Amar Matarin, Chad Amar Asurin. So Rav and Shmuel argue on that. One says it's mutter, one says it's also. Manda Amar Matarin. The one who says it's mutter, he says Dichtiv Bamidbar, because the pasuk says that you send the goat to the midbar, so implying that it's like the midbar. In other words, we already have previous psukim that say that it's going to the midbar. Therefore, we darshan that it's like the midbar, which is hefker for anybody to take. Therefore, it's mutter b'hana. Umanda Amar Asurin, the opinion that says that it's Asur, would say Dichtiv Gzeira, because the pasuk says it has to be sent to Eretz Gzeira, and the word Gzeira says, it actually says, it means it's a Lashon of Chumra and a Lashon of Isur, implying that it remains Asur afterwards. So the Gemara says, Umanda Amar Asurin Hai Midbar Mai Ovidlei. So according to the opinion that it's Asur Bahana, even afterwards, what does he do with the word Midbar? The answer is Miborile L'chidatanya. He would use it to teach us what it says in a Braisa, when it says Hamidbara Bamidbar, three times in the Psukim it mentions that you have to send the goat to the Midbar. That means L'rabbis Nervi Given Shilo Beis Elamim. That comes to include not only the Beis Mikdash in Yerushalayim, you would do this, but also when the Mishkan was in Nerv and Givon, also when it was in Shiloh, also the permanent Beis Mikdash, in all of those, you needed to do the Sur LaZazel. Because we have to remember the original context of the pasuk is about the Mishkan and the Midbar. So how would we know that it applies not only to the Mishkan but also to the also later on Mishkan Shiloh, which was semi-permanent, it had stone walls, the Beis Mikdash, which is completely permanent. So yeah. The Ritva says actually we're not necessarily learning from the number of times it says Hamidbar, it's rather more. The Pasuk says in one of these Psukim, it says that you send it Hamidbara, and yeah, it could have said Midbar, it could have said Midbara, Hamidbara, so therefore so you're able to dash in these various things from it. So anyway, see, he says it doesn't show that the word Midbar means it's multiple Hana, it just means that you have to do this no matter where the Mishkan or the Beis Mikdash is located. According to the opinion that it's mutar b'hana, what does he do with the word gzeira? He says mibor l'chadatanya. He uses it for what it says in a brisa. When the pasuk says gzeira, ein gzeira el chatucha. The word gzeira means something cut off. In other words, it can't be a mountain that has a slope to it. It has to be a cliff that just is cut off. The land is cut off and goes straight down. Dover acher ein gzeira. Another explanation is the word gzeira means something that gets cut apart as it goes down. In other words, what we said, the sur is thrown down and it breaks apart as it's falling in pieces as it's falling down. Dover achav, another explanation is gzeira. Another explanation, why is it called gzeira? It means gzeira, like in the sense we usually would use the word gzeira, a decree of Hashem, meaning. Shema Toma, you might say Maisa Toyuhu. This is a useless thing. What kind of kapara is there in throwing a goat down a cliff? Talmud Lema, therefore, the pasuk says, Ani Hashem, I am Hashem, meaning Ani Hashem Gzautiv. I Hashem made this Gzera, that in Lacharoshos Lahara Behen, you have no permission to think, to question it. It's a chukka, yeah. So now, the words Ani Hashem doesn't actually say in that context. The word Ani Hashem is actually later on in Parshas Achrimos when it starts talking about over there about the Arayas. But Maharsha explains, it says over there it's Chukoyse Tishmoru, and then it says Ani Hashem. So it means all of my chukim, including Yom Kippur, which we said before, is described as Chukas Olam. So it includes everything of the Avodah of Yom Kippur, including this, is Ani Hashem, I Hashem made the Gzera, and don't start questioning it. Did ever once explain in the Sikha, actually, the word Yochol over here means, the word Rishus over here, the word Rishus can mean permission, it can also mean ability. You have, for example, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Teshuva that Rishus Nesuna B'Yad Kol Adam, that every person has Rishus to do bad or the opposite. It doesn't mean he has permission. A person doesn't have permission to be bad, it means he has the ability. So the same thing over here that I've talked about, the Pnimius, it means not only that a Yid doesn't have permission to question the Eivishter's Chukim, but a Yid doesn't even have the ability to question them. Okay. So each one is able to understand the other one's pasuk in some way. So we have this machloikus whether the Evorim are Mutar B'Hana or not. Omar Rava, Mistabra, Commander Omar Matorin. Rava says, after all, it's logical to follow the opinion that they're Mutar B'Hana. Loyom Matorah, Shalach Latakala. Because look, the Torah is not going to tell you send off the goat and throw it off the cliff where it's going to end up causing a takala. What's going to happen later on? Somebody is going to find these pieces. He's not going to know that they're from the Sur Lazazel. He's going to end up having Hana from them. If you're saying they're also B'Hana, then you're causing that somebody is doing something wrong. So therefore, the logic is they should be Mutar B'Hana. With that said, though, actually, the Gvura Sari says, I mean, so if somebody else uses them, I mean, it's not like they're necessarily doing an Aveda. They didn't know that it's also B'Hana. And more to the point, anyway, if you're concerned about that, then fine. What do you do with things that are also B'Hana? You bury them. So fine, then the din would have to be, if we said there also was a, so what's the proof? So we would say, if the din is there also B'Hana, then after Yom Kippur, you have to go down, bury them, and that's that. Then nobody will ever find them. So he says, actually, like this. He brings from the Yerushalmi, we learned earlier in the Masechta a number of things that happened differently during Shimon HaTzadik's times versus afterwards. For example, the strip of wool always turned white during his times. The girdle Hashem always came up in his right hand, etc., etc. Another difference the Yerushalmi says is in Shimon HaTzadik's time, and earlier, I guess, the sur would always die when it fell down the cliff over there. But afterwards, not necessarily. Sometimes the Yerushalmi says it would actually stay alive. Now, in our Gemara we had yesterday, where they asked Rabbi Eliezer, "Do you have to go down and kill it?" He said, "Ken yovdu kol evecha Hashem." The Chacham said, "You do in fact have to go down and kill it." The Yerushalmi actually says that not necessarily. Sometimes it would actually survive the fall, and then it would run off into the desert. And eventually, the Yerushalmi says the Srikim, which means like the local Arabs or whatever, would end up eating it. So then according to that, so the Gvura Sari says, or Gemara may be taking that view. So we're not talking about if the animal dies. We're talking about if it stays alive. then if we were to say that it's also bana, then you have a problem. Somebody else is eventually going to eat it. They're going to find this animal wandering around and eat it. And aren't they being over on an isur then? If svikim or goyim, okay, then it doesn't really matter. It's not an isur for them. But if you're going to say, you know, you might have Jewish Bedouins around, you know, who are living in the desert over there. So therefore the logic is that it must be that it's mutar after it's thrown off. Not pieces of meat. He's not going to eat them, but he could feed them to an animal, or he could take the bones and use them. Yeah, I don't know. That's what I'm talking about. Okay.
Even if it survived, it would be damaged for life.
Well, yeah. Well, that's maybe not. Okay. Turn it up on him. We learn in a brisa. Azazel. What does the word azazel mean? It means shehe az v'kosher. It means it has to be hard and tough. The word az means strong. The word kale. Aleph Lamed also means strong. Like you have, for example, a pasuk that's Elei Ha'aretz Lakach. He took the mighty people of the land, talking about Nebuchadnezzar taking people into Golos. So we see that the word Kael, the name of Hashem, when we use the name Kael of Hashem, it means the powerful one. So Azazel means the very hard, strong, powerful clip. Yachol Bayishuv, you would think that, okay, so it could be someplace in a settled area. It doesn't necessarily have to be out in the middle of nowhere. No, Talmud Lamed, Bamidbar, the pasuk says it has to be in the desert. Uminayin Shabbatsuk, how do we know it has to be an actual cliff? Turn it up. Talmud Lema Gzera, that's what we said before. The word Gzera means cut off. Tanya Idach, we learn in another Braisa. Azazel, Kosha Shabaharim. Yeah, the word Azazel means the hardest and toughest of mountains. V'chenuim, Ves Eileh Ha'aretz Lakach, as you have the Pasuk, Ves Eileh Ha'aretz Lakach. So we see that the word Eil means strong. So Azazel means very, very strong. Marsha says a possibility. Maybe also what we're doing is we're taking the word Azazel and rearrange. After all, the word is spelt Ayin Zayin Aleph Zayin Lamed. So where's the Aleph and Lamed together? Marsha says maybe what we're doing is we're taking the second Zayin and moving it together with the first one. So therefore we have Azaz, which means strong, like Izu's giver, and Kale, which means strong. On the other hand, maybe it's also another word that's said on it is it means as ozal, as meaning strong, and ozal meaning to go. Ozal is the Aramaic word for go. So it means going to a very strong, hard place. Tanad ve Rabbi Shmuel, then we learn a braisa from the yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel. Another reason why it's called azazel, azazel shemechaper al maisa uza v'azoil. Because mechaper for the kinds of things that Uza and Azoil did. They were two malachim in the time before the Mabul. Rashi describes it was in the times of Nama, the sister of Tuval Kayin. They came down to earth and they ended up being mizana with human women. So therefore, so the point is that the Sarah Lazazel is mechaper for averus of znus. So the Medrash gives a little more detail about it. That these malachim, there's other different place in the Gemara where it calls them Shamchazoy and Azoil. Anyway, they argued to the Eibishter, you know, before Maisa Bereshit, it says, you know, before Adam was created, you had a whole dialogue over there. Should Hashem is, so to speak, asking the malachim, should I create human beings? And some of them are saying no because they're going to end up doing all kinds of averus, and some of them are saying yes. So now in the years before the Mabul, when everybody was corrupt, when almost everybody was corrupt, so you have some of these malachim are saying to the Eibishter, "Nu, we told you so. Why'd you even bother making humanity in the first place?" And they say, "You know what? You created such flawed beings. No wonder you're having such a hard time with them. We're malachim. We're perfect beings. Send us down to earth, and we'll show you what a kiddush Hashem we made." So the Eibishter sends these two malachim down to earth, and they end up being even worse than the human beings.
They became human beings.
No, but the point is, they still had a certain metzius, a certain koyach of malachim, and yet they misused it. So therefore, so we're saying, so they committed arayas, they committed znus, and therefore we're saying that the sarah of lazozel of mechaper on such things. And it's mechaper on all averus, but an even averus like that. Turn it up on. Talking further about what we said before about chukim that we can't question. The pasuk says es mishpatai tasu. The pasuk says again, this is later on in Parshas Achrimos, you should keep my mishpatim. What are mishpatim? Dvarim she'omala le'nichtavu dinu she'ikasvu. These are mitzvahs, which even if they hadn't been written, it would be logical that they should have to be written. Ve'elohen avodas kachavim, that you're not allowed to worship avodah zarah, is a very logical mitzvah. Ve'gilui arayos, shfichas damim, ve'gezel, birkas Hashem. All of those are things where even if they hadn't been written in the Torah, then common logic would tell us that you have to do that. Yeah, in fact, what the Rambam says, you know, all of these are among the shev mitzvahs min nayach, and the Rambam has in Hilchos Malachim the famous thing that he says that a goy has to keep them in order to be a chassid or masa'olim, he has to keep them because the Eved has said so and told us through Moshe. Whereas if he keeps them only because they're logical, then he's not a chassid or masa'olim. So we see that these are all logical things which a goy might realize on his own have to be done or not done.
If they're so logical, so why, number one, why does the Torah have to remind us? And number two, the goyim don't respect them.
Because it may be logical, but a person might still do it anyway. So like this, also, when we do them, we're not just doing them because of logic. Ultimately, we're saying even a goy has to do them because the Eved said so. How much more so us Jewish people? Adrabah and Hasidus talks about the idea that mishpatim you have to keep with the same kabbalas oil as chukim, even though you're going to say I understand them, I understand the reason for the logic for them. Ultimately, the real reason to keep them is because the Eibush has said so. And yeah, they have to be stressed over and over because these are things that a person is likely to want to do. Avodah Zarah, for example, as we're going to learn tomorrow, or we're going to learn the next day. Be'ez Hashem, we're going to learn on Shabbos. Be'ez Hashem, they had tremendous yetzer hara for Avodah Zarah in those days. All right, let's go on. On the other hand, when the pasuk continues, you should keep my chukim. That means dvarim shas satan meishiv aleihen. These are things where the satan would try to answer back on them. And on the side of it, he also brings, and Rashi brings on the pasuk, that the goyim also would try to refute them and say, why are you bothering with them? Ve'elohen achilas chazir, that you're not allowed to eat chazir, ulovishas shatnez, v'chalitzas yivama, the fact that chalitza makes a yivama mutter to marry anybody else, v'taras mitzoda, v'soda mishtaleach. Marshall says, why are we mentioning specifically all these things? For example, among kashrus, why are we singling out dafka eating chazir? And he says, because each of these things, you have kind of like an opposite thing within in itself. For example, chazir, you're not allowed to eat chazir, but the Gemara tells us in Chulin, there's a kind of fish whose brain tastes like chazir. So we see, so it's not the Torah doesn't have a problem with the taste of it. So therefore, the Satan and the Umas Olam are likely to say, see, the Torah has nothing against the taste, it's good stuff, why don't you eat it? The same thing with each of these other ones. Levishas shatnez, you're not allowed to wear shatnez, but you're allowed to for tzitzis, and you're allowed to for the big dekorah. In fact, it's a mitzvah too. Chalitzis yivama, how is it that beforehand it was a mitzvah to marry her, and now after chalitza, it's also for you, the brother-in-law, to marry her? Taras mitzoda, how is it that you have two birds, and one of them is killed, and the other one is sent off free? Soda mishaleach, the same thing. You have two se'irim, and one gets brought as a korban, lefnai v'lefnim, and the other one is being thrown off a cliff in a desolate area. So he says that's why, for example, we don't mention over here, let's say, paradruma. Now, paradruma, we usually think is the ultimate choik. But on the other hand, now it's true, paradruma has something that the people who are involved in making it become tame, but it's matire other people. But that's not the kind of disconnect that we're talking about over here. The kind of dove over here, pochoi, the kind of oxymoron that we're talking about over here, where one is opposite the other. We're talking about within the actual doing itself, you have something and you have the opposite of it. So they're likely, the Satan and the Umas Olam are likely to go and argue, why should you bother with it? So Shvashema Toma Maisitoyuhem. So you might say all these kinds of things are nonsense doings. Tamad Lema, Ani Hashem. Therefore the Pasuk says, I am Hashem. As we said before, Ani Hashem Chakaftiv. I, Hashem, have established these mitzvahs. Ve'en lecha reshus lahara behen. You have no permission, and as the Rebbe says, no ability to even question them. We said in the Mishnah, Emesai Matame Begodim, at what point we said that the person who sends off the Sura Lazazel becomes Tomei and his clothes become Tomei. We said, at what point does that happen? We had two opinions in the Mishnah. One was when he leaves Yerushalayim, and the other one was when he pushes it off the cliff. So, Tanan Abanam, we learn in a Braisa, Hamashaleach Matame Begodim. First of all, the Pasuk says, Hamashaleach as a Sura Lazazel, Yechabis Begodim, implying only the one who actually sends it. The one who sends him does not become Tomei. Meaning Rashi says the people who are accompanying him, we said people accompany him from Yerushalayim to the first sukkah, they don't become Tomei because they're not the Mishaleach, they're not the ones who are sending it. They're the ones who are sending off and accompanying the Mishaleach. So they don't become Tomei. Also, you would think that he becomes Tomei as soon as he leaves the Azara. No, Talmud Lema, Hamashaleach. Therefore, the Pasuk says, the one who sends, which is implying that's already being sent out toward the Midbar, when he just leaves the Azara and he's still in Yerushalayim, he's nowhere near the Midbar. But, But it says Hamashaleach, so maybe it means only when he actually reaches the cliff does he become Tomei. Tamad Lamev Hamashaleach. No, because the Pasuk says V'Hamashaleach, and the one who sends, which implies there's a certain ribuy over here that becomes Tomei at an earlier stage once he's already in the process of sending it. Ha-ketzad, so what does that mean? When does it become Tomei? Mishiyetzeh chut v'chom is Yerushalayim divir Rabbi Yehuda. So Rabbi Yehuda says it means once he leaves the wall of Yerushalayim, then he becomes Tomei, as we said in our Mishnah. At that point, he's already called Hamashaleach, because now at that point, he's already on his way to sending it to Azazel. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi says, no, the fact is, the Pasuk says, Azazel v'chippis, the expression of the Pasuk is, Hamashaleach has asar la Azazel yechabes v'radav. So it puts the word Azazel next to the word yechabes, implying Adshi v'yelatzuk. So only when he actually reaches Azazel, the actual cliff, only then does he become Tomei, says Rabbi Yossi. Now, that's not an opinion we had in the Mishnah. We had in the Mishnah, we had two opinions. We had Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yehuda saying once he leaves Yerushalayim, Rabbi Shimon saying once he pushes it off the cliff. Now, Rabbi Yossi is a third opinion who says that he has to reach the cliff, and once he reaches there, that's when he becomes Tomei. Rabbi Shimon says, let's look at the Pasuk again. The one who sends the Sar La'azazel. So Rabbi Shimon says, you, Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, are taking the view that Mashaleach means to send it, as in other words, to walk with Yerushalayim, to walk out of it, to walk out of Yerushalayim and in the desert with it. No, Rabbi Shimon says the word Mashaleach means to actually send it off, in other words, to send it off the cliff, to throw it off. So Yechavis B'gadim has to wash his clothes, meaning Zorke B'vas Rosh, means he throws it all at once, he throws it down in a sudden motion, or Matam B'gadim, and then when he does that is when he becomes Tomei, because he learns that's what Hamashaleach means, only when he actually throws it off the cliff. No, so the Mashaleach, we said, means him rather than the Shaleach. So yeah, the Kohen Gadol who sends him doesn't become Tommy. The people who accompany him don't become Tommy. So yeah, so we have three different opinions. The Rambam Paskins like the first opinion, like Rabbi Yehuda. So therefore, he becomes Tommy as soon as he leaves Yerushalayim.
This is how we learned about the circus people being alive. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, we learned about those people from different countries that
From Alexandria, from blah, blah, right, it would pull on his hair or whatever, right?
So the bridge would be pulled.
And perhaps just the bridge would be just a little bit away, maybe not even all the way to the first sukkah. Maybe just, I mean, you're not going to have these babbly, you're not going to start wandering all over the place just in order to be able to pull on the guy's hair. Once they see him going, they're happy, yeah.
And they're pulling on the sari or they're pulling on the person?
We said the two different possibilities. We said the metalshim, the saroi, that could mean they're pulling on his hair, it could mean they're pulling on the sari's hair, yeah. Like we said yesterday, like Marashah said, you know, they're saying any moment somebody might do another Aveda. And if we ask, so get it out of here as fast as possible. Okay, good. Thanks, everyone.